We're going to continue. Yeah. Okay, Western Motors Magazine, on the back here. Let's turn our Bibles to the 8th chapter of Deuteronomy. We're going to continue. We're picking up where we left off last week. We made it through verse 10. We'll pick up with verse 11 tonight. And we left off where the Lord was speaking through Moses and reminding them that they had gone through this wilderness as a time of training, as a time of equipping and preparation for them for when they would come into the promised land. There were lessons that they needed to learn. Some of them weren't easy lessons. They were hard lessons. And yet it was God all along trying to equip them for the new lives that they were about to encounter. And they were about to go. Moses is kind of preparing them. They're on the banks of the Jordan River, as it were, ready to cross over into the promised land. And Moses is preparing them because they are going from lives of abject poverty and slavery to being relatively living opulent lifestyles. They're going to cross the river, and almost instantaneously, they were going to become people of means by the standards of that day. They were going to have houses that they didn't build and vineyards that they didn't plant. They were going to have pasture lands. They were going to have grain flowing, and it was all going to be given to them in a very quick manner. And the Lord was concerned with how they would handle that, how they would be able to assimilate this newfound wealth. And that's going to be what he talks about this morning. We can repeatedly see that kind of dynamic being played out with professional athletes that would maybe go from a slum environment to all of a sudden making multiple tens of millions of dollars a year, and how oftentimes they handle it, or a lot of the entertainers and various celebrities that we know that come from humble means to all of a sudden into the mega richness of celebrityism and lottery winners. You know, you always hear the story about some guy that wins the mega jackpot lottery and how it ends up ruining their lives before it's over with. And it's because they don't know how to make that transition. They don't know how to handle this newfound wealth once they get it. And this is going to be a lot of what the Lord is talking about in our text tonight. He says, beware, verse 11, that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I commanded you, which I command you today. You know, disobedience comes when we either forget or we don't recognize his goodness. You know, we a lot of times when we're at a place of need, we will oftentimes call out to the Lord. We'll cry out to him. We'll say, oh, Lord, I need you. Would you help me? Would you do this? And we're all the time surrendering to him during a time of need. But then when we don't have those needs, we don't tend to request as much, because we have everything that we need. And so we're not as dependent, we're not as reliant upon the Lord at those times. And there's a big danger of disobedience creeping in at those times. And this is what Moses is warning them about. And he says, so keep heed to these judgments and statutes that I'm going to command you today, lest when you have eaten and are full, and have built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when you're herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied. You know, when you've been there, when you've got that, and everything is going well with you, take heed, beware, lest when that happens. And notice he says in verse 15, not if, but when, in verse 14. And, you know, there's kind of there is something that I think when I can remember when I first started off as a Christian, when I was a new baby Christian, and I was so needful. I was so dependent. I didn't know the Bible, and so I couldn't quote a lot of scripture. I didn't know a lot of theology and doctrine. I had a lot of baggage in my life, and I was having to pray quite often that God would help me with this and help me with that. And there is a danger, I think, sometimes when we get into the groove, when we go past that point of abject dependency, to where we can kind of sort of get on the cruise control, when the pieces start fitting together a little bit and we start kind of having things that's somewhat under control, that we start just kind of, I have a friend who used to call it gracing out. You know, I'm just gracing out kind of thing. And we just, like, we're just cruising through life. And we somehow, sometimes, I think, equate that time in grade because we've been doing this for a while. And we've got our sea legs under us. And so we start equating that with growth. We think we're growing because things are getting easier. And in actuality, it's kind of the opposite of that. You know, there's a big danger that we need to take heed of because we can sometimes get in that automatic cruise control mindset and then forget about the world altogether. And so he's encouraging them, don't do that. And then he says in verse 14, he says, and when this happens, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness in which there were fiery serpents and scorpions and a thirsty land where there wasn't any water, who brought you water for you out of the flinty rock, and who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers didn't know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do you good in the end. And then you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. You know, he says, when this happens, when you realize that there's going to be the manna every day, there's going to be the water from the rock every day, there's going to be the giants in the land that fall at your sword, there's going to be my provision for you every day, be careful that you don't come to the place where you think you've accomplished something. Remember in the book of Judges, in chapter 7, when God had called Gideon, and he says, I'm going to use you to deliver the Midianites into your hand. And so Gideon, reluctantly, but eventually he got on board and he kind of said, okay, let's go do it. So he sent out a call throughout the land, and he gathered together 32,000 Israelites to go do battle with the Midianites. And then they found out that the Midianite army had 135,000. And so Gideon goes to the Lord, and he goes 33,000 versus 135,000. God, I don't like those odds. And the Lord said, no, I don't either. Those aren't very good. That's 4-1. Those odds are too much in your favor. If you guys were to win with the 4-1 odds, you would be thinking it's just because you're so bad. And so he tells them, he says, tell everybody that's a front row, send all the fatty cats home. And so he does. And he's thinking, you know, maybe you'll have a few here and there. We'll kind of pack up and leave. Two-thirds of them leave. And they're left with 10,000 guys. 10,000 versus 135,000. And God says, I don't like these odds either. I mean, that's 14-1. And I know you guys, I know that if you were to go in that battle with 14-1 odds and win, you'd think it was because you just had some sort of secret strategy. He says, so he tells them to go down to the brook and get a drink. And he takes them all down. And you remember the story from Sunday school. The guys that got down and laughed like a dog. He sent them home with the ones that just kind of reached down and scooped the water up and brought it to their mouths. These were the ones that he kept. And I've heard a lot of guys teaching themselves, these were the ones that were alert, they were the ones that were looking, they were the warriors, they were the ones that would be most suited for the battle. They were the ones that were, you know, on the lookout. And they didn't get down and stick their face down in the water. It was the ones that just scooped up the water. They were the ones that got kept because those are his. God just needed a few good men. But that seems to be kind of contrary to the whole purpose of it, doesn't it? I mean, the purpose of it was God didn't want a few good men. God wanted a few old and flabby men. You know, he wanted some guys that couldn't get all the way down there to scoop up the water with their lips. He wanted guys that could only get down on one knee and bring it out. He wanted guys that couldn't do battle. And so he ends up with 300 over-the-hill, flabby, gray-headed, arthritic old men. Don't laugh at me. And God says, okay, 145 to 451. These odds I can deal with. Because he knew if it was anything less than that, they would somehow start taking credit for themselves. And we can read that story and we go, you know, nobody's that silly. Nobody would be that way. And yet, don't we do that every day? Isn't that something that we have to constantly be on guard against? You know, the greatest tragedy of all of this story here, and the greatest tragedy, I think, of our lives, is that when all the work is over, whatever the work may be, you know, the work of our service the Lord, the work of our walk with Jesus. Well, that is over. And it's been His grace. And it's been His Spirit. It's been His presence. When all that's said and done, we kind of like to take credit for ourselves. We kind of like it when people say what a good job we've done. We kind of like it when somebody pats us on the back. And not in so many words. No, I mean, we never say, well, I'm trying to acknowledge how much time I spent in preparation for that, or how much diligent effort I put into it. We would never be like Nebuchadnezzar when we'd say, oh, behold this great Babylon, which I have built. We know better than that because we read the book of Daniel. You know, we don't want to even be cows in the field for 7 years. But do we think in our hearts? You know, are our hearts lifted up? And we think what a great thing we have done. And so He's encouraging them, don't do that. And then He says in verse 18, and you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is He who gives you power to get wealth, that He may establish His covenant with you, which He swore to your fathers as it is to this day. And then it shall be that if you by any means shall get the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. As the nations which the Lord destroyed before you, so shall you perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. Now, as we've seen many times, God had a covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He made a promise. He was going to fulfill that. He's not saying, I'm going to change my mind on that. He's just saying, if it's not going to be you guys, if I can't fulfill the promise through your generation, well, then I'll just wait for the next one. And, you know, God will always, we see repeatedly throughout the Bible, He's always working through a remnant. And He would do so with them. But He says, if you end up going the same way as the guys that you're displacing, then you'll be displaced as well. And as He continues, remember, this is the second of the 5, 4+1 sermons that Moses gave in Deuteronomy. And He's writing into this, the longest one of those sermons. He's continuing it in chapter 9. He says, hear, O Israel, you are to cross over the Jordan today. And He doesn't mean like in the next 24 hours. He means this is the time, this is the period when it's going to happen. You are to cross over the Jordan today and go in and dispossess the nations greater and mightier than yourself. Cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the descendants of Anakim, whom you know and of whom you've heard it said, who can stand before the descendants of Anak? You know, He's saying, look, I don't want you guys to have any kind of a kind of attitude toward this. You're going to go fight some giants. There are going to be some obstacles for you in the land. I want you to know that. I want you to take a very sober, objective evaluation of what's going on. Don't let that discourage you. In fact, it should encourage you. Because I have promised you that you're going to be able to do it. And, you know, this is kind of somewhat of an aside, but I think it's kind of in context. A lot of times when I hear gospel presentations today, when I hear preachers giving an invitation or they're presenting the gospel, and it's always like, how many people want to get saved? You know, how many people want to have it's all presented as very, sign up for this today, and boy, wait, you know, if you sign up before midnight tonight, and we're going to double the offer, and it kind of grieves me sometimes when I hear this, really. Jesus didn't do that. When He presented the gospel, He always told them to count the cost. It is the best thing going. It is what we were created to be, is to be a child of God. That is His will for us, and it is why we are placed here on earth. But there are giants in the land. You know, there are obstacles to overcome. But that's not to discourage us. That's just to cause us to have a very sober and objective evaluation of what we're getting in for. Yes, there will be battles. Jesus says in the world, you're going to have tribulations. But then He said, but guess what? You can cheer up because I've overcome the world. The battle belongs to me. I've already won it. So don't let that discourage you. In fact, that would encourage you, because even though you're going to have great battles, you're going to have a greater battle on your side. And the victory will be even greater. And I think that's what Moses is doing with them here. So therefore, He says in verse 3, understand today that the Lord your God is He who goes over before you as a consuming fire. And He will destroy them and bring them down before you so that you shall drive them out and destroy them quickly, as the Lord has said to you. I can remember the first time that I failed as a Christian. Probably given my life to Him, and I went out and I'll be a Christian for Jesus. I can remember the night when I gave my life to Him, and I was kind of struggling with Him. I was arguing with the Lord over it, and I was saying, Lord, I can't. What is it going to do for me to respond to this invitation right now? Because you and I both know what I'm going to do. I can't walk that walk. I can't be like you guys. I don't know how to express it any more than I kind of came to a place where I couldn't say no to Him anymore. It's like my argument's all ran out. And so I finally just surrendered and said, okay, God, you got me. I surrender. I give up. I'll give my life to you. And I can remember the first time it was tested a couple days later, and I failed. And I went home that night, and I was praying to the Lord, and I said, Lord, I told you I couldn't do it. And He said, Ken, I told you you couldn't do it. And therein lay the rub, because I thought I could do it. I thought it was going to be up to me to do it. I thought it would be dependent upon me to go and do it in my strength and gain the victory in my own efforts. And God is saying from the very beginning, you can't do it. You can't. Even on your best day, you can't. And Ken, you didn't have a very good day today. You can't do it in your strength. Walk through with the old Martin Luther line, one with God is the majority. And that's what he was saying to those guys. He said, let's whittle it down to a ratio of 450 Midianites to one Israelite. Do you realize what that means? Every Israelite would want to kill at least 450 Midianites himself in order for them to win the battle. And if you only kill 400, then it would be up to your sidekick to kill 500. You have to make up the slack. That's kind of what the odds say. They're ludicrous odds. They're overwhelming odds. And God says, that's what I want. I want overwhelming odds so that when I get the overwhelming victory, I will receive the overwhelming prayer. Do not think, He says in verse 4, in your heart, after the Lord your God has cast it out before you, saying, because of my righteousness, the Lord has brought me in to possess the land. But it is because of the wickedness of those nations that the Lord is driving them out from before you. It is not because of your righteousness or uprightness of your heart that you will win to possess the land, but because of the wickedness of those nations that the Lord your God drives them out from before you, that you may fulfill the word which God spoke to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, He gave them the land of Sodom and Gomorrah too. There were two reasons why He gave them the land. He was bringing them into the land for two reasons. One of them is because the unrepentant wickedness of the inhabitants. He said, when the iniquity of the Amorites is full, after 430 years, I'm going to bring you guys back in the land, and I'm going to drive those guys out. And so for over four centuries, His grace was at work. He was trying to show them His ways. He was trying to get them to repent from the decadence of their debaucheries. And they just continued to be, read some of the accounts of the archaeologists, if you will, and you can see how totally depraved those societies, that culture of Canaanites was in the days of crossing the Jordan. He said, they're unrepentant, unregenerate, and I am going to drive them out, as I said. And secondly, the second reason why you're going to do this is because I promised Abe, Ike, and Jake. I promised, it was a solemn promise to your grandfathers that I was going to do that. Therefore, understand that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness. For you are, I know it sounds like we've had to do it once, but He says, for you are a stiff-necked people. He says, don't think you're good because you guys are good, because actually, not so much. You know, it's not because of your righteousness. It's not because you're so good-looking. It's not because I just looked down from heaven and I saw you guys and I just thought, pinch their cheeks, you know, they're just so irresistible. How can I not take them in? And he says, it was just the opposite of that. And so he says, remember. Three times in our text tonight, he tells them to remember. Four times he says, don't forget. Remember. Lest you forget. Because, see, if we just let things take its natural course, if we just let things pan out, we'll forget. You know, forgetting is not something that happens casually. I mean, remembering is not something that happens casually. Forgetting is the natural way. And he says, so remember, don't forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness from the day that you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place. You've been rebellious against the Lord. He says, don't forget. You have to make a conscious effort. You have to put into practice not forgetting. You can't just say you're not going to forget and then not forget. You have to actually not forget, or you'll forget. And what Paul said to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is this. In verse 12, he says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he falls. If somebody thinks that they can get, and if somebody thinks they can stand on their own 2 feet, they're setting themselves up for a fall. If somebody thinks, okay, I got it now, God. I thank you for all your help so far. I don't know how I got here without you, but I can take it from here. You know, I know I was doing a bad job of steering the car earlier, and so I gave it to you, and you kind of straightened things out, and you cleaned up the engine, and you fixed the taillights and everything. It's running pretty good now, so I can take it here. I'll take over the wheel now. And you know what he'll do? He'll give us the wheel. He's not going to play tug of war with us over it. He's not going to fight us over it. He's not going to argue with us. We say, I can take it from here. He'll give it to us. And you know what we'll do? We'll run off into the ditch again. If anyone thinks he can do it, then take heed, Paul says, or he'll fall. And we do it every time we try to do it ourselves. And he says, in verse 8, also in Horeb, which is Deuteronomy, is the way of saying Mount Sinai. He says, also in Horeb, you provoked the Lord to wrath so that the Lord was angry enough with you to have destroyed you. You know, he says, if you think what I'm saying is not true, you second generation of Israelites who are standing at the banks of the Jordan just about ready to cross over into the promised land, if you think what I'm saying doesn't really have a whole lot of substance, you 21st century Oklahomans sitting in Carver Chapel on a Wednesday night, if you think this isn't valid, he says, just take a look at your track record. You know, just look at how well you've done driving prior to this. How well you've done being in control of your life up to this point. How's your resume look? And of course, we realize that we've never been able to do it before. Why do we think we can do it now? He says, remember how you guys were back in Mount Horeb? I mean, as soon as I got you out of the land of bondage, the first thing you did was begin complaining. And you immediately reverted to idolatry. He says, verse 9, when I went up into the mountain, this is Moses saying, when I went up into the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord made with you, and then I stayed on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and neither ate nor bread nor drank water. But the Lord delivered to me the two tablets of stone written with the finger of God. And on them were all the words which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly. And it came to pass at the end of the 40 days and 40 nights that the Lord gave me the two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. And then the Lord said to me, rise, check this out. I think this is pretty cool. This is God talking to Moses. And Moses is telling them what God said to him. And so God says to Moses in verse 12, arise, go down quickly from here. For your people, God says to Moses, whom you brought out of Egypt, have acted quickly. And they have quickly said, they're not my people, Moses. You're the one that did it. And Moses said, all I did was let him steer. You know, not me. But God says, your people, whom you brought out of Egypt, have acted quickly. And they have quickly turned away from the way in which I commanded them, and they made for themselves and hold an image. And furthermore, the Lord spoke to me, saying, and I have seen these people, and indeed, they're stiff-necked people. So let me alone, that I may destroy them and blot out my name from under heaven, that I will make of you a nation mightier and greater than they. He's saying to Moses, he said, you know what, I'm just so fed up with them right now. I tell you what, just let me whack them, or just toast them right now, get rid of all of them, all 2.5, 3 million of them. And I'll just take you and your sons and we'll start a whole new children of the promise. And the Bible tells us that Moses interceded for them. He prayed on their behalf. And God didn't do it. Now, was God going to do that if Moses hadn't prayed? I mean, isn't God sovereign? What was God going to do what he was going to do? Would God have actually wiped it out if Moses hadn't stepped in front and pray on their behalf? We don't know, because Moses prayed. I believe God's sovereign. I believe God's going to do what God's going to do. But I also believe that there is something about prayer. There's a dynamic of prayer. There's a power in prayer that we can't even begin to understand and imagine. That a sovereign God who holds the entire universe together by just simply the power of his will to do so. A sovereign God who knows the end from the beginning. Who looks from his vantage point and Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden are just as present tense to him as the battle of Armageddon is. The sovereign God somehow, in his sovereignty, uses my prayers to direct his hand. I don't understand that. I don't get it. I can't even begin to figure it out. But that's what happened. And so he says in verse 15, so I turned and I came down from the mountain. And the mountain burned with fire. And the two tablets of stone were in my hands. And I looked, and behold, you had sinned against the Lord your God. And had made for yourselves a molten calf. And you turned aside quickly from the way which the Lord commanded you. And then I took the two tablets, and I threw them out of my two hands and broke them before your eyes. You know, it wasn't like he said, oh, you guys are so messed up, and he threw it down, and he says, you better take that. He was showing that you have broken, you know, the joke is that Moses opened and broke all the commandments at once. He said, you guys have broken the commandments. You guys have broken the law. This is what you have done to the law. When he shattered it in front of them. He says, I fell down before the Lord as at the first. 40 days and 40 nights, and I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all your sin, which you commanded in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord to provoke you to anger. And it looks to me, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it looks to me that what that is saying, that after Moses came down from the mountain, he saw the children of Israel worshiping the golden calf, and he took the two tablets of stone, and he threw them down, then he turned around and went back up on the mountain for another 40 days and 40 nights. We always talk about Moses going 40 days and 40 nights without water and food, but it looks like he went 80 days and 80 nights without water and food. Not that we go, oh, Moses, you beat the Lord's record. It's not that. This is a miracle. Okay, nobody can go 80 days and 80 nights, and you can't go 40 days and 40 nights in the desert without food and water. You can't do that. This was a miracle of the Lord that he sustained him during the time. That's the point. It's not that, like, oh, Moses is his character. It's not that, it's that God was provide for him. God was his Jehovah Jireh during that time. And he says that I did it again, and for I was afraid of the anger and the hot displeasure with which the Lord was angry with you and destroy you. But the Lord listened to me at that time also. He says, so I went back up there and started praying again, and guess what? God listened to me. It's not like he counted to 10, you know, Moses kind of talked you down, you know. It wasn't that, but Moses' prayers ministered to the Lord. And the Lord was very angry with Aaron and wanted to destroy him. So I prayed for Aaron also at that same time. Remember, when Moses came down and he saw all the people doing this bad stuff in front of the golden calf, and Aaron is standing there. And he's Moses' brother. Moses left him in charge. You know, I'm going to be gone for about a month and a half. Take care of things. Don't get back. He looked at Aaron and said, what's going on? He said, all I know is they threw their gold in the fire and just looked a clump out. You know, what would you have done? I mean, that was Aaron's response to that. I mean, if God was mad at the children of Israel, you would think he would have really been doubling down on Aaron, you know, trying to excuse it like that. And so Moses spent most of his next 40 days praying for his bro, you know. And he says, if it hadn't been for that, God would have grabbed the Aaron as well. And then he says in verse 21, then I took your sin, the calf which you had made, and I burned it with fire. And I took this idol, this god that you guys made, and I burned it with fire, and I crushed it, and ground it very small until it was fine as dust, and I threw it into the brook that descended through the mountain. And he says that the text says he made the people of Israel drink the water that had this. You know, so, like, in the word, in more words of the Hulk, pretty God, you know, he made him drink the water that had the gold from their pretty God that they had made. And then in 24, and then also Jabra and Asah and Kibroth Hattaavah, you provoked the Lord to wrath. He's reminding them, you know, unless they cross over the Jordan River, unless they go there and they forget how they had depended upon him for everything, how they had failed when they tried to do it in their own strength before. And he's reminding them of that, and he rehearses these three events from Israel's history. He says, remember when you're at Deborah, when you're at Massah, and when you're at Kibbutz Hatzavah. Deborah was in Numbers chapter 11. This is a place that means burning. And it was when the fire from the Lord, I don't know what fire from the Lord looks like. You know, was it lightning bolts? Was it fire and brimstone? I don't know, and really have no intentions on ever wanting to find out. You know, but it says the fire of the Lord has descended and consumed the people that were complaining. And so they named that place, it means burning, they named that place Tabor. He said, remember that one? You guys remember the Numbers chapter 11? And he says, and then there was also Massah. This is in Exodus chapter 15, and the word Massah means temptation. And this is when they complain about God's out here in the desert, and he didn't. Not going to provide anything for us to drink. And they brought us out here in the desert just so we could die of thirst. And the Lord told Moses, take your staff and go to that rock and whack it. And water flowed forth from that rock. Enough water for 2 or 3 million people to quench their thirst. Not just months, but for 40 years. He called that place Massah. And you tempted the Lord with your complaining. And then the last place, Kibroth Hatavah, that means graves of lusting. This is also from Numbers chapter 11. And that's when the mixed multitude complained about not having meat to eat. You know, they woke up every day and they had their manna. And then they had their manna, and then they had their manna. And guess what? We're having tomorrow, manna. And after a while, they were complaining about that. They said, we want some meat. You know, when you saw a good Arby's commercial, where's the meat? You know, we want some meat. Give us some meat to eat. And so God brought all the quail. And they had so much that was coming out of their nostrils. That's what the Bible says, I didn't say that. It was coming out of their nostrils. And so they called the place Kibroth Hatavah, Graves of Lusting. Sounds like a B-movie horror flick, doesn't it? Graves of Lusting. And he says, remember that place? Remember that Graves of Lusting place you went to? And then likewise, in verse 23, when the Lord sent you up from Kadesh Barnea, saying, go up and possess the land which I have given you, and then you rebelled against the command of the Lord your God, and you did not believe him nor obey his voice. This is when they got up to the launching place, the place where they were going to spring from there into the promised land, and they decided they would send the 12 spies in. Just do a little reconnoitering first. They sent someone from each, representing from each one of the 12 tribes. And they came back, and then, you know, he adds that the land flowing with milk and honey. It takes two guys to carry one cluster of grapes. And, but there's giants and more grasshoppers, and there's no way we can do it. 10 of them said that, and the two, Caleb and Joshua, they said, well, we can do it. God's something to do it. God promised it. God, the battle belongs to the Lord. God promised that victory is ours. We just got to go take it. But the people listened to the 10 rather than the two. And as a result of that, they spent the next 39 years walking around in a circle. That generation died off in the desert. And now we have this new generation that has come up. Most of them born in the wilderness. And Moses is saying to them before they ever stepped foot in the Jordan, before they ever thought about crossing over, he says, remember that? Remember that example of you guys trying to get the job done by yourselves? You have been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. And Moses had been around a long time. You know, for 40 years he had been leading them around in the desert. And so thus I prostrated myself before the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, and I kept prostrating myself because the Lord had said he would destroy you. And therefore I prayed the Lord. I said, oh, Lord God, do not destroy your people and your inheritance whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and do not look on the stubbornness of this people or the wickedness of their sin, lest the land from which you have brought us, should say, because the Lord has not ever bring them into the land which he promised them, and because he hated them, he has brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. Yet they are your people and your inheritance, whom you brought out by your mighty power and by your outstretched arm. You know, by this time, you know, God says, remember your people that you brought out of Egypt? He wasn't saying, they're your people, you brought me to the land of the claim at this point. You know, it's not embarrassing. It's your kid. He's from your side of the family, I can tell. Neither one of them wanted to claim him at this point. He's your son, not mine. And he says that they are refusing to recognize that it was by prayed for them, and he reminded God. Now, was this all something about, oh, yeah, I forgot I made a promise. Thanks, Mo. Good call. You know, I don't know if that worked. I don't know what's wrong with my memory lately. No, it wasn't that at all. I mean, this was a test of Moses, right? This was a test to see, for Moses to see what he would do in a case like this. I knew there was going to go wrong. But he said, you have made this promise. And it's a world. Remember when they did cross over in Jericho and they went to Rahab's house, the two spies went to Rahab's house, and she said, we've heard about this thing that God's promised you this land, and we're all shaking in our sandals. We're all quivering in our sandals. Because we know that we've seen what he's done so far, we have no doubt that he's going to do it from here on out. This was the Canaanite they had us a land where they were being judged. They had more faith in God than the Israelites did. At that time, the Lord said to me, give yourself two tablets of stone, like the first, and come up to me on the mountain, and make yourselves an ark of wood. And I will write on the tablets the words which were on the first tablets, which you broke, and you shall put them in the ark. So I made an ark of acacia wood, two tablets of stone, like the first, and went up on the mountain, having the two tablets in my hand. Now we see this use of acacia wood repeatedly throughout the books of Moses. When they built the tabernacle, you know, here the covenant of the ark, I think this is just like a summarized reference to the ark of the covenant. But they would, all of the tabernacle was composed of the wood that they used. There's only basically one kind of wood that grows in the desert, and that's acacia wood. And this is a picture, this is what I took from Bus, so it's a little boring, but this is a picture of acacia wood in the Judean wilderness, of an acacia tree. It's not very big. It's not something that you go down to the lumber store and ask for a bunch of fine acacia wood plywood, you know. It's not, there's not a whole lot of lumber in that thing. I mean, this tree itself is only about 8 feet tall. And yet, that's the only kind of wood that they have in the wilderness, and that's what they use to make the ark and the planks and everything else in the tabernacle. And he says, they wrote on the tablets according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord had spoken to you in the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them to me. And I turned and came down from the mountain, and put the tablets in the ark which I had made, and there they are, just as the Lord commanded me. Moses is just kind of a sideways way of saying, God told me to do it, and I did it. Do you see the pattern here? He told you to do it, and you didn't. If he tells us to do it and we do it, we become blessed. If he tells us to do it, we don't, then we suffer the consequences of it. Now, the children of Israel, verse 6, the little parenthetical statement here, you see. The children of Israel journeyed from the wells of Bene Jaakan to Moserah, where Aaron died and where he was buried. And Eleazar, his son, ministered as priest in his stead. And from there they journeyed, and I don't know where they came up with the name of this place, but it's a good God. From there they journeyed to Good God. And from Good God to Jotbatha, the land of waters of river. And at the time the Lord separated the tribe of Levi to bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, to stand before the Lord and minister to him, and to bless his name to this day. Therefore, Levi has no portion or inheritance with his brethren. The Lord is his inheritance, just as the Lord your God promised him. So he just kind of throws in this little parenthetical statement here that when they were traveling, the duties of the carrying the ark and the tabernacle and all that was given to the Levites. And when they would go into the land, they weren't going to receive a tribal allotment. Tribe of Dan got one, the tribe of Manasseh got one, Issachar got one, Judah got one, Simeon got one. All the other tribes got a tribal allotment based upon their numbers, the people, except for the Levites. The Levites did not get a tribal allotment. They got some cities. They got cities scattered around throughout all of the promised land. And the reason was because he wanted them to know, as they were his representative priest people, they were the privileged ones who had to serve at the tabernacle. And he wanted them to be a representative of one who God is their provider. God would be their sustenance. He would be their inheritance. He would give them what they needed. And of course, you know, we as New Testament Christians, we are that royal priesthood that the New Testament Peter talks about, and the Lord is our inheritance. It's not to say that we shouldn't have retirement and 401ks and that sort of thing. That's all fine. We should plan for the future. But the Lord is our provider. The Lord is our sustainer. The Lord is our inheritance, just as it was for the Levites. As at that time I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, and the Lord also heard me at that time, and the Lord chose not to destroy you. And the Lord said to me, arise and begin your journey before the people, that they may go in and possess the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. And so, again, we see Moses praying. And if we would just take the text, if we would just take this text and take it out of its context, it would sound as though God was obeying Moses. And we know that's not the case. We know that God is not in any threat by our prayers at all. We don't twist his arm. We don't get him to take it back. We don't get him to change his mind through our prayers. We know that. We get that. We understand that. But I think God would have us to understand the power of prayer. That Moses, as he persisted in prayer, he persisted in praying for his brother. He persisted in praying for the people. Even when the great temptation had been given to him to let him wipe the people out and start a whole new people under Moses, Moses said, let's do it the other way around. Wipe me out. Take me out. And preserve your promise to the people. You made this promise and you've got to see it through. There's a power in prayer. There's a dynamic of prayer. There's an effect of prayer that I don't know that we can fully understand. I don't think we can fully grasp. It's been twisted and theologically by a lot of people over the years, and I get that. But I don't think we should run away from it because we don't understand it. Prayer changes things. And it says in verse 11, now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? He says, here's the whole thing. Here's the deal. Here's what we're going to get down to, the whole nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts of it. I gave you my law. I gave you my commandments. And you guys rejected it. You guys threw it away. And I'm going to be faithful to my promise to you. I'm going to be gracious to you. I'm going to be merciful to you. If you want to know what I require of that, if you want to know, you know, when you say, God, you mean you're not going to toast us right here? You're not going to turn us into grease spots? You're going to give us grace instead? What would you do? What would you ask of us then? He says, here's what the Lord requires of you, but to fear the Lord your God, walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments of the Lord and the statutes which I command you to this day. Are handy today for your good. He says, here's what I want from you. Here's what I want. What I want you guys to do is to be mine. Yeah, I want you to be, we use the word sanctified, and that sounds so churchy and religious, but what it means is I want you to be set apart for me. Here's what I want. I want you to be my children. I want you to receive my love, and then as a result of that, respond to that love in kind. I want you to walk in obedience to me because I'm your dad and you're the kids and obey me and then you will reap the benefits of that and you will be blessed in the land. You will have purpose. You will have abundance and you'll be full. But I'm afraid you're going to forget. I'm afraid that when you get there, you're going to forget about it. He said, I want you to keep all the commandments of the Lord your God and his statutes that you do so for your good. And even that's something that we so easy for us to forget. That God's commandments are for our good. It's really easy for young people to forget. Because we say, well, God, you gave us all of these desires. You gave me these wants and these urges and these things that I want. And then you put up all these rules and say, don't do it. It doesn't seem fair. I mean, that seems like your commands, your will for me, your laws are bad. You're mean. It's easier for young people to forget. It's easier for older people to forget them. It's easier for older people, especially older people, because they went, God, I've been faithful to you all these years. And what do I get from it? You know, what's my reward in this? And it's easy. The devil loves to take either one of those sentiments and manipulate them and maximize them. And we just think, you know what? We forget that it's for good. That when God says don't do something, it's not because he's mean and arbitrary. It's not because he wants to see how far he can push us. It's because if we do it, it'll be bad. If he says don't do it, it's because if we do it, it'll be bad. We'll suffer the consequences. It'll hurt us. It'll kill us. If he says do it, it's because if we do it, it'll be good. If we don't do it, then we'll suffer the consequences of that. His commandments, his statutes, his will for us is for our good. It's easy for us to forget because the devil loves to extort any kind of twisting of that. You know, sometime ago, many years ago, some rabbi on the Sabbath, not too much to do, he sat down and counted all of the thou shalt nots and all of the thou shalts and all of the Pentateuch. And he counted them all up. There were 10, 613. Yeah. 365 negative, 248 positive. He counted them all up, he categorized them into the thou shalts and the thou shalt nots. And by the time we get to the New Testament, by the time we get to the time of the Pharisees, they had made doing the do's and not doing the don'ts, they had turned it into a fine art. They had turned it into an exact science. And they could cross every T and they could dot every I and they could get just, the guys, the teachers, the leaders of the Jewish people, they had it going on. I mean, people would look at them keeping the law, not doing the don'ts and doing the do's. They would see them doing that so many times again. That's all very publicly, I might add. And they would see them doing that, and they would just think, man, those guys have no show. I can never be as holy as they are. I can never be as righteous as they are. Those guys must be so close to God. And then along comes Jesus. Friend of tax collectors and sinners. Along comes Jesus. And he says to them, one day as he's teaching them about the kingdom, he's got all the people listening to him. He's telling them about what the kingdom of heaven is like. And he says to them in Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, for I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. And then they were like, wait, what? Unless our righteousness exceeds theirs, theirs is so high we'd never even get close to them. And he said, we've got to be better than them. How can that happen? That's not good. At least nobody can get there. If the scribes and the Pharisees can't get there on their righteousness, what hope is there from you? Well, that's why you should give up. Why even try? I knew I couldn't do it. And I said, yeah, I know you can't. I know you can't. But they even came to Jesus in John chapter 6. They came to him and they said, you know what? What is it you want from us? You're teaching things. You're teaching the ways of God. You're teaching us the ways of righteousness. But what is it? What should we do that we can do the things that God wants? What should we do? What do you want? What are the works of righteousness? And he says to them in John chapter 6, verse 29, this is the work of God, that you believe in him when he said. And we think, well, there's no way I can keep those 613 verses, do better than that. The Pharisees do the 613. I can't do that. And you said I got to do better than they do. But then you said that better than them is believing in him. I can do that. That one I can do. Believe in him who sent Jesus. I believe in you. You alone have the words of eternal life. Yes, I can trust in you. You can do it. I can't do it, but you can. And he says in verse 14, indeed, heaven and the highest heavens belong to the Lord your God, and also the earth with all that's in it. The Lord delighted only in your fathers to love them. And he chose only in your fathers to love them. And he chose their descendants after them above you, you above all peoples, as it is to this day. Therefore, he says, circumcise the foreskin of your heart, and be stiff-necked no longer. Now, and if you're studying the Bible and you've looked at the kind of religious system that Jesus was dealing with in the first century, when he was telling them that their righteousness had exceeded that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you know, that what they had done is they had gotten the physical part of that circumcision thing pretty well down pat. They were pretty proud of that. They had that one wired. And they thought because of that, that they helped them accomplish the spiritual side of circumcision, the circumcision part. They had the circumcision in the flesh, and they thought, well, they equated that with the circumcision part. And we look at that and we're silly Jews. Boy, they missed the boat. You know, if they would have just known, if they just realized that he was really talking about their hearts and not their bodies. But then so many of us miss both. You know, we don't circumcise our bodies or our hearts spiritually. You know, we don't sanctify ourselves in body or soul. But we believe. You know, Jesus rose from the dead. You know, me and the man upstairs kind of a thing. And it's, I don't know how many times I've been told, me and God have this agreement. And somehow it's like he condescends to our common denominator. And well, I'll just take what I can get kind of a thing. He says, for the Lord your God is God of gods, Lord of lords, a great God, mighty and awesome, and shows no partiality nor takes a bribe. He administers justice for the fatherless and the widow, loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore, love the stranger, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt, and you shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve him, and to him you shall hold fast and take oaths in his name. Thomas Watson, a great Puritan, died for a long time ago, said, mercy is not for them that sin and fear not, but for them that fear and sin not. That's where the Pharisees missed it. And I think that's where so many of us missed. He said, you shall fear the Lord your God, and you shall serve him, and to him you shall hold fast. And now, that you shall hold fast. If you have the old King James, it's the word cleave. It's the same word that's used in Genesis chapter 2, where God says, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. Be cleaved to his wife. It's the same word. It means glued. The bond. He says, therefore you shall be glued to me. To him you shall hold fast. You shall be glued to him and his will and his word. Mercy is not for them that sin and fear not, but for them that fear and sin not. He is your praise. He is your God, who has done for you all these great and awesome things that your eyes have seen. Your fathers went down to Egypt with 70 persons, and now the Lord your God has made them as the stars in heaven in multitude. Moses' exhortation to them, Moses' reminder to them, is that, you know what, it started off because you've got a gracious God that picked you out of nothing and made you into something. It's still about grace. It's always about grace. It's his grace. It's his grace. It's his grace. And it's his grace that is sufficient to transform and conform us and to allow us to have righteousness greater than that of the Pharisees, because it's his grace that causes us to believe in him. He's not just somebody with whom we have an agreement. He's not the big guy on the man upstairs. He's Lord God Almighty. And yet he has condescended to us in the person of Jesus. He made himself like us so that we could become like him. That's grace. It's always grace. It's great. But your grace is sufficient, it is powerful, it is dynamic to change, to soften even the hardened soul. May we never lose sight of it, Lord. May we never forget what you've done for us, what you are doing for us, and what you have promised you will continue to do until the day that we stand before you face to face. And Lord, let that remembering sanctify us. Let that be what cleanses us and glues us to your will. ask all in Jesus' name.